Well, I hate to say it, mate, but it's like a drug. Football to me is, I mean, you get a little taste for it when you're younger, but when you get lucky enough to do what I do and be in the stadium when Bayern win the treble, that's mainlining the pure stuff.
Welcome in to episode 8 of The Heart of the Game, the show where we get to know the voices of football. I'm your host, Nate Abaurea, and in this edition of the show, we get to chat with one of the most colorful and endearing characters in the world of soccer broadcasting, a prominent voice in the English language of the German Bundesliga, our good friend, Phil Bonny. This one was a lot of fun, so without further ado, let's get stuck into this thing. So I've got to know how a humble lad from the south coast of England, a man from Southampton, became a prominent voice of the German Bundesliga. Where was the link between the south coast of England and the nation of Germany, and specifically German football, Phil?
Well, now you've opened a can of worms, haven't you? It's quite simple, and I suppose it's pretty much the same as most people who are into football. I've always been into football, grew up with it. I had the classic education in football, my grandfather taking me to see Southampton FC play for the very first time as a young man. And you only go and see them get thrashed once, and you're instantly hooked and can't wait to see them get thrashed every other weekend. Joking aside, no, he took me to see my first game of football, my grandfather, but the whole family's football mad, like all kids, kicking the ball around in the garden. I was in every school team. I was in every Cubs team, youth club team, all the way through my life. I was never good enough to be in the starting 11, but I was on the bench. And if Billy, my friend, hadn't done his homework and couldn't come, or if somebody else's had visitors and wasn't allowed to play, or they got injured, then I got a game. But, I was never good enough to be a pro. I've got a weird and varied background. I wanted originally to be an actor, seriously, at the age of 12. The football was never going to be an option because I wasn't good enough. Didn't have the killer instinct. So I pursued a theatrical career and was lucky enough at the age of 19 to move from Southampton to London to attend one of the best drama schools in the UK, which I'd got an audition for and managed to pass. So I then studied there for 3 years and left the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art in 1987 and promptly was unemployed, like most actors once they graduate from drama school. During my time that summer, helping out, there's a little known side to me is that I actually do stage fencing. It was one of the things that I was good at, having always been a footballing, cricketing, tennis player, and most sports I can play to a half decent, give somebody a good game as long as they're not a professional sort of level. And I was helping my combat master, the fight choreographer that taught me, John Waller, who was also incidentally the fight choreographer on Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He's no longer with us, sadly, but a great man, a legend in the fight choreography world, where I bumped into my future wife in this time, 1987, in the summer. We stayed together and both of us were in theatre. She also attended Lambda for a while. The long and the short of it is, as most actors or people with any acting enthusiasms out there will know, most of the time you spend your time working behind a bar, doing market research, that sort of thing, because the jobs are few and far between. But she grew up over here in Germany, in Cologne, despite having British parents who moved out of the UK to Africa in the 50s. They had to leave suddenly due to upsetting the local dictator at one point. And they arrived back in Cologne, Germany. She was from there, grew up there. She came over. We lived together for 10 years. And then when she was offered a job over here. She took it, and my career was not particularly advancing at any great pace in any way, shape, or form. I decided that, having visited her parents over those 10 years, two or three times a year, as most people do, you go home for Christmas, Easter, or Thanksgiving, I suppose, in the States, you would do the same. So I turned up here and was starting sort of from afresh. I came over to be what is known as a houseman over here, basically a house husband. She would go to work and I would do the cooking and washing and that sort of thing. It didn't last long. A couple of weeks after arrival, my brother-in-law, also involved in theatre, got involved in a production of Romeo and Juliet. They wanted to do it with sword fighting. And he said, oh, I know somebody that's just arrived from England who's quite handy at that. So he put me forward. And it's actually something I still do to this day, is when I'm not commentating football, I choreograph fencing for film and theatre and television. And I also teach at a local drama school once a week on a Wednesday, unless there's Champions League on, of course, and then I might be somewhere else. But it's a lot. It's, you won't believe this story. It sounds like I'm making it up, but to cut it long and short, after choreographing the Romeo and Juliet, the artistic director of the theatre said, "Oh, I've always wanted to do the Three Musketeers." And you have to remember, I didn't speak any German when I first arrived. Outside of, you know, how much is that? Can I have another beer? And where's the toilet? He said, "Oh, I see from your CV that you are actually a trained actor. Would you like to be in this production that we're about to do of the Three Musketeers?" He said, "You can choreograph it and be in it as well as the Duke of Buckingham, because he's English anyway, and it doesn't matter if you sound funny." So I got that gig, and then they moved on to Cyrano de Bergerac, and the guy that had played D'Artagnan was going to play Cyrano, and they said, "Oh, well, you can play the guy who he kills in the first 10 minutes. He doesn't have much to say, he just has to die." And so I choreographed the fights for that. Then they said, "Oh, we're going to do Rumpelstiltskin at Christmas as the kids' show. There's no fighting in it, but we think you'd make quite a good Rumpelstiltskin." So I got that. And anyway, I'm trying to cut a long story short, but as you know, I quite like the sound of my own voice. You might have noticed over the years. I worked with that theatre for quite a while. At the same time as this was going on, my wife started working. The job she came over to do was at the Deutsche Welle. And Deutsche Welle is like the German version of the BBC World Service. It's an international broadcaster, but it's owned by the German government. Originally a child of the Cold War that was set up to broadcast over the wall into the old former East of Germany, with obviously unbiased or slightly biased to the West, obviously propaganda, I suppose you would say. But for years and years and years, a source of good, clear, fairly unbiased news for Africa and Asia and around the world. But they also produce television programs. And part of my training, obviously, as an actor is as a voiceover artist. And this is where it starts to get interesting. This is where the footballers out there will, the football fans out there will get interested. One of the guys that used to direct the documentaries that we used to make, which used to be varied from ships in Hamburg harbor to zoos in Berlin. But one of the directors that would direct that, also someone with other jobs rather than his main job, as it were, was a gentleman called Toby Charles, who used to, and you see, there's the connection. He obviously in America is very well known for being the voice of the Bundesliga soccer made in Germany. And Toby and I obviously hit it off and would always talk about football. And he's a great Borussia Mönchengladbach fan, incidentally. But we would always talk about Gladi, as he calls them. And at one point, he just turned around and said, "Oh, by the way, they're looking for somebody," because every now and then he has like a holiday, or if he was sick or anything, they were looking for someone to fill in. And he said, "They're looking for somebody. Do you think you'd be up for it?" So my classic answer is I thought it over for about 0.0001 of a second before saying, "Yeah, sure." I did a sort of audition, which was also quite nerve-wracking. I did the audition and they said, basically, "Yeah, great. You start next week." So I was in. And that was my first season was 2003, 2004. Philip Lahm had just gone off to was just loaned out to Stuttgart at the time, and he was just starting his career. And I'm still going, but he's retired. That's all I say.
My favorite part of all of that, Phil, is that you opened that up by saying it's very simple. You know, that whole story about drama, stage fencing, dictatorships and democracies, house husbands, Shakespeare and Toby Charles. It was all just a very, very simple thing that just really fell in place. I love every bit of that. I love the fact that your theater background is really what opened the door to your football commentary career. And it's just the most obvious question I have to ask of the similarities between the two and the concept of performance and being behind a microphone and being, for all intents and purposes, still, after all these years, despite the fact that the craft may have changed a little bit, or you're still involved in the theater, clearly, but as far as how people who are listening to this show know your voice as a football commentator, as a prominent international voice of the German Bundesliga, how often do you see it all kind of tie in together for you, the performance aspect and the theater roots that you have when you're just calling a German football game?
Well, it's a very good question. The thing is, the football is, it was my first love. The football is what I love. My first memory is kicking a ball against a wall in the back garden of my parents' home. So the football's been with me all the way through. And I must say, I played for the drama school football team as well and sort of organized that. Yeah, wherever I've gone, I've always been involved in football. I mean, it's one of those things, I believe, you don't have to be Ronaldo, but you do have to know what Ronaldo's trying to do. And you do have to know how difficult it is. There's one of the worst things is when you hear a commentator, and I do hear them, and I'm sure everybody feels the same thing. The ball comes across, Lewandowski tries to get his head on it, it glances and goes over by a couple of feet. And the commentator says, oh, well, that was a golden opportunity for Lewandowski. And as someone that plays, you know that, my God, how on earth did he get anything on that ball at all to even steer it anywhere remotely close to the goal? It was almost impossible to get into that position. What a brilliant player. And there is that difference between the two. But back to your original question, the love of the football, the love of the game, it's also a job. It is a job, and you have to, my wife, I'm sure, thinks that it's just like, you know, here we are, you and I, we're having a drink, you a cup of tea, and I'm possibly something stronger later on. But the thing is, it is a job. It takes a lot of research. You have to be permanently trawling through the internet, finding out little gems of information about people, making sure that you know who did what and who said what, which I'm not always brilliant at, I'll be honest. But at the same time, nobody wants to hear, I don't think, oh, well, that was a nice goal. Well done. You know, somebody's got the ball. You have to build the tension. You have to inform, but not, you're not, you shouldn't really be the center of attention. You should enhance what's going on. And I try and do that. I try and go through the gears in my voice so that I don't do everything at this incredibly high. Wow, what a fantastic game this has been. I can't believe that we've seen so much. Because that kind of gets strenuous as well. So I like to try and use the different levels and, oh, we really dug that ball out from somewhere. And if it goes on and it gets higher and then you can explode. But hopefully it adds to the game and doesn't detract from it, if that makes any sense.
It makes perfect sense. And going back to the performance aspect, I think that might actually raise some very unique difficulties for someone like yourself being from a scripted theatrical background. I mean, I'm sure you did plenty of improv as well, but you're talking to me about Shakespeare. You're talking to me about full-on theatrical productions that were a huge part of your life at such a critical juncture in your artistic career. And when we're talking about a football match, we're talking about something that is live. That's the most compelling part of a football match. We don't know what's going to happen. The stark simplicity of what we love about football. Going back to the Peter Drury interview on this very show of there's nothing like 1-1 or 0-0 in the 80th minute. We don't know. It could go any way. It's on a nice edge as opposed to a scripted theatrical performance. So I'm curious how you have harnessed that and learned to really get lost in the unknown, the beautiful unknowns of football. And specifically who, I know you talked about Toby Charles and what an influence to have in someone who, you talk about public broadcasting. I mean, that was through KQED. San Francisco was the original public broadcaster that brought Soccer Made in Germany to U.S. television back in the 70s and 80s. And Toby Charles, so well known around the world, so many cultures have love for this man. So in addition to Toby, I'm very curious who some of the football commentary figures and voices, whether in Germany, back in England, or wherever, who the folks who really helped you learn how to be the best football commentator that you can be, because you clearly have the theatrical background, you got the performance background, but who really helped you become a proper voice of the beautiful game, Phil?
Well, it's good that you actually say it, because I should actually give more credit and gratitude to Toby Charles, because he took me under his wing. Of course he did. We were friends. And Toby's still fine. He's in Spain, locked down right now. They're trying to get him back over here to Germany right now. But for anybody that's interested, Toby's still very much alive and kicking. And he took me under his wing, showed me the ropes, showed me what I should do, showed me what I shouldn't do. And then, like all masters and apprentices, a bit like Darth and Luke Skywalker or Darth and Obi-Wan Kenobi, it was there was a point where I said, well, yeah, but Toby, I've got to read it and do it so that I can do it for me rather than for anyone else. And whoa. One thing I'll never do again is upset Toby Charles, because you don't want to get on the bad side of him, that's for sure. He let me know what he thought about that. But I grew up like most English kids did. I'm 55, so born in 1964. The 70s, the heyday of Southampton Football Club, 1976. I was 12 years of age. We won the FA Cup for the only time to this date. Obviously, we hold out hope for seasons to come. But all the classics. More recently, obviously, you talk about David Coleman and all Brian Moore and all those guys, but also just modern voices like Jonathan Pierce. I really hated him when I first heard his voice, when he was commentating at the time in London, because he used to shout quite a lot. But after a while, I realized that actually, that's kind of what I want to hear. I want to hear people getting enthused about the football. I don't want Jones, Smith, oh, fine goal from Brown. I want somebody to have the same excitement as I do, because when I'm watching football, that's what I'm thinking inside. I try to be non-partisan, and if the football's rubbish, I will say it's rubbish and hopefully why and what they could do to improve upon it. It's hard to say that I had just one influence. I hear things that I don't like, and I hear things that I do like, but I don't necessarily try and copy anybody. I'm always wanted to be myself. You know, even going back to when I was an actor, I didn't want to be the next Laurence Olivier. I wanted to be the first Phil Bonney, if you grasp my meaning. It's but there are, I watch so much football. I'm sure everybody does. Anybody who's a football nut like most of us, you watch so many commentators. It's almost hard to point out people like the people that do, like, the in England you have Match of the Day on a Saturday. You know, some of the guys that I work with work on that as well. People like Mark Scott. Yeah, I love listening to my colleagues as well. We've got a great bunch of people that do the Bundesliga. It's a real, I won't say family, but it's a real team spirit more than anything else. Nobody's trying to climb over someone else to get the better games. Everybody gets their game, and we're enthusiastic, and we talk about it, and we swap ideas and info. Maybe family feel is more like a team that you're very much in the middle of. Everybody gets on incredibly well. That's one of the great things about this particular job, is everybody we work with, including all the backroom staff, they are all top-notch people who know their job, know what is expected of them, what's expected of us, how we can help them, how they can help us. So I'm missing it quite a lot, as you can probably gather by by the roomy look that I have in my eyes right now, and a little tear. But that happens over summer when there's a summer break. So, you know, just the particular instance that we're having right now, hopefully, is just a hiccup, and we'll continue. But you were talking as well about the improvisational side of things. Now, here's a little secret. I don't know what my colleagues feel about this, but I would much rather commentate a live football game where you don't know what's happened than what we have to do directly after the game. I'm not sure how many of your listeners will be aware of the kind of production line that takes place in our particular area. We not only commentate the live game, we then have to put a 2-minute highlight together that has been cut down for us by our assistant producers. That is not scripted by them or anyone else. It's scripted by us, and that has to be out and around the world. It has to be arriving on people's mobile phones or cellular phones an hour after the last whistle has gone. So there is an incredible amount of fast typing that has to be done, and I'm kind of old school. So I was the last generation probably that didn't have computers or typewriters in the school. Well, we did have a computer, but we had a computer, and only the five math nerds were allowed anywhere near it. You know, the rest of us were held off with cattle prods, because all we wanted to do was try and download Pong or something like that onto it. But so my typing's not as fast as some of the other guys. Some of the other guys, it's like watching Liberace play the piano. They're really fast. So that's the bit I hate more than anything. It's not reading it out. Once I've written it, I can read it out without making a mistake and read it out first time. But if you've got somebody standing over you tapping their finger on their watch going, come on, this needs to be up and on the server so that people can start watching it. That's not brilliant. And then after that, there's another highlight that we do for the 1 hour highlights of the entire weekend. And again, that is sort of scripted highlights, but it's more bullet points, which is much easier, because I particularly like improvising, as you said, part of the training that I got was about improvising. It's learning not how to trip over what you're saying. And a lot of people have mentioned over the years that I have what they call it, the Phil Bonney pregnant pause. When you hear that, it's me thinking of what to say.
Well, what are you going to say now, Phil?
Well, I'm going to say, as I said to you earlier on, something I've always wanted to say on calling up people in your part of the world is good morning, San Diego. What a lovely morning. Rain and more rain.
I love it. Yeah. Pouring rain here in San Diego, and just this bright, glorious sunshine back in Cologne. We've flip-flopped today, but we will get some nice spring blue skies. But as we, yours truly and Phil actually joked before this call, the rain hopefully keeping everybody inside at the moment. And as we continue through this storm and on the other side, I'm confident, echoing off of the last episode of the show with our good friend Taylor Twellman, that we will make it through this, and that we will be singing for football. We will be in the presence of the beautiful game on the other side of all of this, and we'll be better for it, and we'll appreciate the beautiful game more than we ever did, and that's the mentality that I definitely want to have as the host of this show, and just as a student of the beautiful game, a fan of soccer. So I want to go back to the original football fan Phil Bonney, because there's a two-parter here. I want to go back first to Southampton. I want to go back to the Dell. I want to go back to the humble roots. You talked about the going and just seeing the first time that you saw Southampton get smashed, and you said, you know what, they're my club, I'm hooked forever. One of the most unique football grounds that I've ever seen, and I was so lucky where the way I cut my teeth as a young kid in the States, and the little bit of access that I had, it was right in the mid to late 90s. And so Matt Letizier is one of my first footballing heroes. And I was watching this guy who looked like he might as well be working at the chippy. Like, I might see him at the tire shop down the street in my hometown of Watsonville, this working class regular lad who would just make other world-class footballers look like fools. He made, I'll never forget him making Peter Schmeichel look like an absolute fool as a goalkeeper, chipping him at the Dell one time and watching those games. It felt like they were from another era. They were in the late 90s, but I got to see the Dell. I got to see something that went back 100 more years. And you said you got to experience it back there in the 70s. When you think Southampton, when you think the Dell, when you think your original football memories, what are the first few things that come to mind, Phil?
Oh, I've got goosebumps when you just sorry. But like most football fans, I've got so many bazillion memories of the memories of being a child, of being too young to go to the football, and my entire family turning up. They would come from my father and his father before him were both shoe repairers, they had a shop where my father worked with my grandfather. But my uncle and his two sons, who were much older than me by about 8-9 years, they would come on a Saturday. It would be a special thing. They'd drive up from where they were living every other Saturday, and they would all go, and they'd take a box for the youngsters to stand on, and they'd all go with my granddad and both granddads and my dad and my uncle and my two. And I was not allowed to go. It was because I was too small. And this is how, I mean, I must have been about 3 or 4 at the time. And this had a profound effect upon me. I was so, so very jealous of them. So that when the time came and I was actually allowed to go with my grandfather, it was, I'm going to darn well enjoy this as much as I can. And I soaked up every single second of it, the trip there, because we walked, and as you walk, more and more people come along, and you're all wearing the same colors. And of course, in those days, in the 70s, it was people with rosettes and with rattles and hats and scarves, so it had this wonderful flavor, and everybody talking with each other. And are we going to win today? Well, I don't know, it's Manchester, you know, it could be a difficult one. And that was kind of like my birth as a football fan. But then came the teenage years, when all of a sudden you get to about 15 and you're in with a group of friends, and the lads go, it's Ipswich midweek game. Shall we go down and go in the chocolate boxes? The chocolate boxes were kind of reserved at the ground for the youth. And in those days, of course, it was just the youth. I'm very happy to say it's no longer that way. Of course, it's mixed, both men and women, and girls and boys. In those days, it was just the youth. And at 15, 16, I saw some brilliant men. Kevin Keegan and Alan Ball and Armstrong and Watson, hundreds and hundreds of names. Southampton was a team that had a reputation of taking players in the autumn of their careers. Charlie George came to us and I saw him play. Alan Ball was another one, as I mentioned, who came, and Keegan, of course, and Steve Moran and Andy Townsend. There were just loads and loads and loads of names. But then going along to see them, and if you look on the internet, you can Google it, Southampton FC chocolate boxes, and you'll see old black and white. They were prefabricated concrete monstrosities behind the goal that looked like boxes, and they packed the people in those days. And the Dell wasn't the massive sort of, I think at its biggest, even with all standing, I think they only got about 26,000 in there. Once it went to all seater, then it was reduced down to about 16,000 or 17,000. But it was an incredibly intimate pitch where you could reach out and touch the players when they went to take a throw in, much to the chagrin of some of the visiting players, obviously, because they were really within punching distance, I suppose, is what you would say. The awful times back then. But that was my teenage years. And then as I got older, into the sort of 18 year Phil Bonney, I was working in my summer holidays in a restaurant, obviously, because that's what actors do. And the restaurant was frequented very often by players of the local team of Southampton. And Kevin Moore was there at the time, and his dad was running the play, he was the manager at Southampton, and I think it was Kevin Moore. Yeah, he would always say, "Got a ticket for tomorrow's game, Phil?" And I go, "Well, maybe." And he said, "Oh, here's one." And he just flop it out of his top pocket and put it on the on the top. But he'd be in there on a Friday, and I'd get to go to the game on a Saturday. Marvelous memories there. And then as I got older, and as of course got the job in Germany, and I'd moved away to London, so I have to now tell you the story of stories that nobody believes me, because I've got no photographic evidence. But when I went to drama school at the age of 19, my parents took me up to London to try and find somewhere to live. And we looked at a few places because we had obviously a limited budget. Looked at four or five different places across London, couldn't find anywhere. We went to various different places that offered, I can't remember what the English word for them is now, but they were like estate agents who had rental houses. And they said, "Oh, hang on a second, do you like football? This one might be for you." And they pulled out an address, and we took the train to Earl's Court, well, up into London, went from Earl's Court down to Fulham Broadway, came out of Fulham Broadway, turned left, started walking up the road, and all of a sudden, obviously, you've come across Chelsea Football Ground on the left-hand side, and the address was the first house, a block of sort of apartment block, just past the Shed End. Walsingham Mansions was the name of this place, and I looked at the number, looked at the bell, rang the bell, and we went up to about the fourth or fifth floor, rang the doorbell, opened the doorbell, and it was a student place. There were like four or five rooms there that students were renting, and a guy called Ecky came to the door and said, "Oh yes, you hear about the room? Oh yeah, that's it's you can have Bill's room. None of us like football." And I thought, "What do you mean by that?" I went into the room, and it seriously was a room. It was about 10 feet square. It wasn't much more than that, with two side windows with a perfect view of the entire Chelsea Football Ground pitch. So I lived there for a year, but I have absolutely no proof other than obviously people who I know who visited me in that time. But I watched Chelsea every other week, and while I was there, Southampton beat them twice, once in the cup and once in the league. It was brilliant, and
you were safely tucked away in your room, not inside the Shed End as a diehard Southampton supporter. You were above the Shed End in your room.
Absolutely, about five floors up. But there is terrible, terrible, terrible danger, because of course every level of stairwell, there's a window that opened out, and the Chelsea fans all knew that. And it was a bit like living at number 10 Downing Street. On match days, we always had a policeman on the door. We'd have to show our key to get in. Otherwise, he wouldn't let us in to our own home, because the fans would go up and open the windows and watch for free, obviously. But if there was any trouble down at Fulham Broadway station, the police would be very often called away to deal with it. And if anybody left the door even slightly ajar, of course, the entire building would fill up with Chelsea fans. I had a Sunderland fan with me one occasion in the cup when Sunderland scored first. And he made quite a lot of noise because we had the windows open. And what he didn't realise was that we'd had scaffolding on the outside of the building because it was being painted. And the fans had got on there, and all of a sudden we had lots of faces at our window. Sort of, "Who's that doing all the shouting? Bring him out here. I want to stick my fist in his face."
That was a proper Shed End homage. I'm glad we could tie some theatre into this. From the chocolate boxes to the Shed End, I mean, you talk about the humble roots of your English football upbringing. I also love there, Phil, this might be the most quintessentially English thing you've said in quite some time. It's certainly one of the most quintessentially English things I've heard on this show. We're talking about all these beautiful football memories, and your first one that came to mind was the disappointment of you not being allowed to go. I feel like there is some very, very beautiful symbolism within that, and the football fan.
It's actually very, very, very deep trauma, Nate, is what it is. Very deep trauma that goes back a very long way. It's why I can't get enough of football today, because I was denied so much of it when I was like four or five.
Well, that transitions perfectly into what I wanted to ask you about. I said there was a bit of a two-part plan there with going back into the nostalgia files and very much feeding into my own historian, anthropological enthusiasm and football romanticism, because I want to tie it back to the present moment, or at least the present era. I've watched you on multiple occasions, or heard your voice accompany massive moments in German football, in German club football. And we're talking about the modern Bayern Munich era, just as one example. But everything that Borussia Dortmund have accomplished over the last decade, so many other great examples as German football has very much risen back up to a new era of prominence. My God, the German national team in the 2014 World Cup and everything that has happened. Some up, some down, certainly, but a lot of ups and a lot of prestige around German football. And there was one video in particular that in reviewing some stuff before this show, I found the gaffer Chris Harris actually sent this link to me. And it was you narrating, just talking over the opening ceremonies of a Bundesliga season. I think it was from a couple of seasons ago. And it was a match at Bayern, and it was the opening ceremonies of the Bundesliga. And it was just this sheer pageantry of the most prestigious, the fireworks, the choreographed smoke, the 18 colored balls representing every club, the light shows at the Allianz Arena, the fans with the tifo. This was as prestigious as club football could ever feel. Is there ever a time in those moments, whether it was that moment right there or others that I'm sure are just kind of reeling off in your brain, of the most prestigious of feels in your German football life, or even just really in your football life, are any of those moments where you ever just think back to a pissing rainy Wednesday night at the Dell, or a hovering above the shed end and having to keep the hoolies out of your apartment building and all the humble, gritty roots that we talk about? How often does a nice proper juxtaposition of gratitude hit the mind of Phil Bonny when you're in those rather prestigious scenarios these days in Germany?
It's like a drug. Football to me is, you get a little taste for it when you're younger, but when you get lucky enough to do what I do and be in the stadium when Bayern win the treble, that's mainlining the pure stuff. It just flows through you, because you maybe it's arrogant, but you just feel, well, this is what football's all about. It's the occasion. Many, many years ago, I'm a Southampton fan till I die. That's red and white for life. That's no joke. But I, at the core of everything, is I love football. Now, in Germany, I don't particularly, one of my things, I try to be as neutral as possible. As I said, if the football's rubbish, then I call it as rubbish. But when you see these moments when Lewandowski scores 5 goals in 9 minutes, and that for me, obviously for a lot of people, it's one of my most iconic moments in football for me. I was standing up, screaming my head off, because it was just, this is what football's all about. And it doesn't matter that it was Bayern or that it was Lewandowski. It's just that a man had done that, having played football all my life, poorly, not as well as him. But to see somebody do that is just, it makes every fiber of your being stand up. Those moments when the gold glitter shoots into the sky when a team's won the DFB Pokal, the adoring moments as a player runs to the fans after a fantastic team goal with 4 or 5 exquisite passes that's finished off into the top corner and leaves the goalkeeper sprawling. These are the moments that we live for, and I try to enjoy them as much as I can when I'm there. But, you know, I've seen our team get kicked 5-0 on a rainy Wednesday evening when it's so cold. And I've still not left in the hope that my team will get one goal back another one of those core memories for me is my granddad, when Southampton were getting beaten by somebody, I don't know, it was probably Tottenham Hotspur or something. Just everybody was going and I said, oh, come on, let's go, granddad, because it's just awful watching them getting a spanking. And he went, no, you wait. He said, if we score now, you watch all those people run up the steps, that all the ones that have gone to be at the top, first in the queue to get their cars out of the car park or whatever, all those people that have gone, he said, it's like going to the theatre to see an Agatha Christie play. And just at the moment when they say, and the winner is, or the murderer is, and then going, you see, you never know. So, you know, and of course, as luck would have it, or well, my granddad had a brilliant eye for football as well, I'm pretty sure. The goal is scored and all these people come running back and the look on their faces and the disappointment, knowing that they probably won't get to see it. Because, of course, in those days, it wasn't the on-demand replays that we have today. And that, for me, was an iconic moment as well. You can't leave before the game's over because, you know, like you said earlier on, you never know what's going to happen. There's no such thing as, oh, it's going to be nil-nil all the way through to the end. That isn't something that we know for sure. It's likely, it's possible, but when you get that last minute touch of brilliance, that Marcel Risser free kick that just rockets past the Gladbach wall and goes into the corner and becomes goal of the season, and you just happen to be lucky enough to be calling that game on that day, those are the moments that, just as a football commentator, you just think, oh my goodness, I could do this every single day for my entire life and I would not get bored ever.
The gratitude is palpable in your voice, to say the least, Phil. And I love that you spotlight the Lewandowski performance, the 5 goals in 9 minutes. There will never be, I don't think that will ever be replicated at that high of a level of football. I think we'll see that in Sunday league from time to time. And if someone pulls that off in a Sunday league match, I'm probably still going to stand up and applaud. Somebody scoring 5 goals in 11v11 full field football in 9 minutes is something that at any level of the game deserves a standing ovation for Lewandowski to do it at the elite level that he did in that famous match for Bayern Munich. It's the stuff of absolute legends. And in addition to that moment, I feel like there's another moment in your personal life that might actually be up near the top of the German memories list for Phil Bonny. I'm going out on a limb here, but I've learned some things about you and your connection, obviously, with your wife and to the city of Cologne, but now to Germany as a whole. I'd be willing to bet that alongside that Lewandowski 5-goal-in-9-minute performance, there's another moment where you, for all intents and purposes, became an honorary German that might be just as special for you. Would you care to tell the listeners about what I'm referring to?
Well, absolutely. It's not an honorary German. It is an honor to be a German for 2 years, nearly. Yes, 2 years. I have been a German citizen. I was able to... under the laws of Germany, I was able to take out dual nationality, which means I keep my British passport and I also am able to carry a German passport as well. So now the biggest problem comes, footballing wise, when England play Germany. If they have to meet each other in the run in, then please in the finals of something. And after that, we can talk about it. But it's certainly something that I'm very proud to have done. I've lived in Germany for 25 years. It's difficult. There's a lot of us around who over the last couple of years have found it profoundly difficult with the Brexit situation. When I always try and explain it like this. In the 1970s, the British government gave me, a young British lad, the opportunity to move to Europe, where I could work unhindered, I could have free movement, I could build a career, build a life, get married, have a child. And that was great. And I've done so. And I did that for 25 years. 2 or 3 years ago, they said, we're going to have a vote to see whether or not you can continue doing that. But because you've lived there so long, we're not actually going to allow you to decide whether or not you can continue living there. Now, that as maybe you can say, yes, I've lived here for 25 years, so I've been paying tax in Germany and earning my money from working for the Bundesliga, albeit in English. But as everybody has a right to, I have an opinion on that, and I think it's a very narrow-minded view of the world, and would very much like to continue living here. And if I wanted to retire, which is never going to happen, they will carry me out horizontal from the commentator's booth. I'd rather not retire. But if I ever wanted to move to France or Spain or Portugal or even Holland or Belgium or any of the other countries in Europe, I am able to do that now without having to worry about pension and insurance and medical coverage and the like. But I've lived in Germany, as I said, for 25 years. You can never stop being British. If you're born in Southampton, you don't suddenly switch and turn everything off. But what you can do is realize that there are a lot more, the horizons are a lot higher. I always remember one of my favorite scenes in The Blues Brothers is when they turn up at the country and western saloon bar place, and the lady says, "Oh yes, we have both kinds of music here, country and western." Obviously she didn't come from South Wales, but the point about it was I learned with music as a kid, you know, you don't just like rock music or you don't just like rap music. You like music that you like. I'm a bit like that with my football too. You know, I live in Cologne and I kind of sort of follow them. It has to be said. I don't often admit to that very loud, but you know, they play in red and white. They used to be better. They get beaten all the time. It's just like being at home in Southampton, really. But when they play Gladbach, it's not. If Gladbach play well and score great goals, I'm going to shout just as loudly because I'll have enjoyed it just as much as if it was Köln doing it the other way around. So. Don't get me wrong in those terms, because, you know, this is the whole thing about Europe as well. It's like I am British, but I love living in Germany. I love being 4 hours away from Paris in a fast car, 2.5 hours by train from Amsterdam. You can go on holiday to the south of France, drive down 10, 11, 12 hours with a break in between, share the driving with someone else, and you're there. To go to the UK, it only takes me from Cologne when we drive back. If we hit the Channel Tunnel at the right time, it only takes 7 hours to get back to Southampton. 7.5, 8 hours with a break in the middle. The world is much smaller, and Brexit for me is kind of a step back into the past. People are entitled to their own opinion, but mine is I'd much rather be a European and stay here. German people. Are not the same as the British people. They have many, many similarities. It's not for nothing that the Brits are Anglo-Saxons. It's one of my favourite lines as well. They share a lot of common beliefs and ways of doing things. Perhaps the Germans slightly more stiff in their the way they see themselves. The Brits maybe slightly more self-deprecatious. But all in all, it's I'm very happy to be able to have the best of both worlds. I'm greedy, really. Yeah.
And a dual citizen and a fan of the game itself. I love that. I have to deal with that conversation so much here in the States, and the sort of classic mindset with broadcasters. You gotta take your partisan cap off. And I always kind of hear that and go, nah, I'm gonna flip that whole mentality on its head. I know who I've supported. I know who I like, and me liking and supporting them is what's going to make me actually be the most neutral commentator possible. And I mean, you just explained that better than I've ever been able to. The example with if Gladbach score the goal against Cologne, it comes back to being a fan of the game itself, and that's what it's all about. So you are preaching to the choir and then some here, Phil. And to close this out, this has been such a great pleasure and privilege having you on the show and adding you to the list of just fabulous football commentators that we've had here on the Heart of the Game, a question that I've asked most everybody, and you can take as long or short as you want to answer this final question here. When it comes to the craft of football commentary, what do you, Phil Bonney, love the most? What is it? If you could pinpoint one or two things that keep you coming back for more. You said they'd have to drag you out horizontally and pry the mic from your hands before you'll ever stop calling games. Why is that? What do you love the most about football commentary?
Wow. That's you could have given me a forewarning on that one, but what do I like most about it? I like most that I get the chance to hopefully add something to people's experience of the game without being too much of a clever dick about it. I really love about it is the challenge as well from a working point of view is the challenge of that improvisational nature. And you said it yourself so well, you never know what's going to happen. When Germany went into the semi-final against Brazil, if you'd have told me 5 minutes beforehand that they were going to win 7-1, I would have laughed you off the pitch. I would have laughed you off wherever you were. It's just this one. It's such a privilege to be this close to the game. As somebody who would I would really have loved to have been a professional. I mean, it's an incredibly hard business. I don't blame any professional for getting as much money as they can out of the game, because you never know that one slid tackle that takes your knee joint out and your history. But being so close to the game is such a privilege. What I love about commentating is, and this, I'm probably get some hate mail for this, but just me, Phil Bonney, who loves football, sitting next to someone like Stefan Freund that played in the 1996 Germany when they won the Euros, or sitting next to Stephen Cherundolo, USA captain, and have them turn to me as just this kid from Southampton that's really annoyed that his grandparents didn't take him to see the football. But when they turn around and say, yeah, Phil, you're absolutely right, that's why that happened. Or, well, you know as well as I do, Phil, that's a purely selfish sort of buzz that it gives me, because I never got to play professionally like they did. I never sacrificed the health and of all my joints like they did. But to be treated as an equal by them is a real blast. But I love also as a commentator to heighten the drama, the suspense, the experience that other people are having, hopefully. And so far, people have been fairly positive over my work over the last 15, 16 years or so. And I just hope I can continue adding to people's enjoyment of the game. I suppose that's probably what I enjoy most about it, is the fact that you listen to people out there saying, oh, yeah, that was great. And, oh, I'll always remember when that happened. And, oh, Phil's commentary just added to the moment. And that sort of comment that I sometimes read on Twitter and places is something that really makes me feel proud of what I'm trying to do. And hopefully they will continue to enjoy me shouting out people's names for money.
Well, you have certainly added to the enjoyment of this very podcast. Phil Bonney, thank you so much for joining me here from Cologne to San Diego. This has been a great honor having you on the show, and you are welcome back anytime, my friend.
Absolute pleasure. And anytime, at the moment, things being what they are, I've got a little bit of spare time that I can invest doing these sort of things.
And that's going to do it for episode 8 of The Heart of the Game. Another huge thank you to our friend Phil Bonney. For everybody at worldsoccertalk.com and the gaffer Chris Harris, my name is Nate Abaurea, saying hasta la próxima. Bye for now. We'll talk to you next time on The Heart of the Game.